Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of The Full Stack Leader. We're excited to have Gabriel Bordeaux with us. Gabriel is the head of engineering at Confiant, a technology company based on the East Coast. We'll let him tell you a little bit about the organization. Gabriel's had a long storied career as an engineering lead and a project manager and running several of his own businesses over the course of time. Additionally, Gabriel's from France, so we look forward to hearing a little bit about the region that he comes from and how he got started in his career. So welcome, Gabriel. It's great to have you here.
Hey, thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're excited to hear some of the stories you have and some of your tips on leadership. Maybe you can first tell us a little bit about your career and where you've been.
Sure. So currently, I'm head of engineering at Confiant. So we are a 40 people startup that fight against the threat of malvertising. So what we do is we help publishers protect themselves against bad ads that can affect the people that visit their website.
That makes sense.
So we created an innovative solution that allows us to detect bad ads before they are rendered on the website in a matter of milliseconds. And we can even replace them with other ads to help publishers not lose revenue.
That's a really challenging area. I actually was involved in it a little bit earlier in my career, and I know some of the engineering behind that's pretty complex.
Yeah, it's a fairly complex task. So we have some automatic tools to do that, but something awesome at Confiant is we have a pretty great security team, and they help us. They can analyze suspicious ads and find security threats within them, and then block them and report them to publishers.
It's an industry that's really filled with a lot of fraud. And I know that's a big part of the challenge that all ad tech entities face over the course of time. I'm sure you have a few unique experiences within dealing with fraudsters around ads, right?
Yeah, for sure. There's about 1% of fraud in ad tech. And it's at like all levels of the spectrum. And it's a really big deal for publishers. So we work with large websites like MSN, eBay, Business Insider, like Politico, and many other large websites like that. And we help them protect themselves and their users.
That's amazing. So where did you get started? How did you get into this?
Okay. So pretty much it all started at the time where I was entering high school. So my parents, they bought me a really cool calculator called the TI-89. I don't know if you know about it.
Is it the Texas Instrument?
Yeah, it's a Texas Instrument. And
I think I know the one.
It was like, I think it's discontinued by now, but it was one of the better models. And what you could do on it is you could program on it. There's a language,
right?
TI Basic. And
right.
I don't know how familiar you are with a basic language, but TI Basic was like the Texas Instrument version of the basic language. And you could program on it, like using your calculator's keyboard, using the small display, and you could take full advantage of that 256K of RAM it had to offer.
I love it. It's like the iPhone before the iPhone.
Yeah, for almost. So what was really cool about it is just like the iPhone, that you could connect it to a computer and you could upload programs from the internet and put them on the calculator. And that's how I started my first website when I was 15. I created a website to showcase the programs I was creating for my TI-89.
That's amazing. Did people come visit the website?
Well, it's hard to tell. So it was in the year 2000. And in the year 2000, you know, the analytics tool, it wasn't what it is today, but I got some feedback. There was some forum and people were talking about it. So I created a game that was a slot machine and you could play slot machine on your TI-89. And people would download it and use it. And what's funny is I still have the calculator today and I still have the game on it and I can still play it. And it worked. It worked pretty well. There is a little design of a slot machine on it that I drew pixel by pixel on the calculators using the calculator's keyboard.
Wow. Using every single character within the calculator itself to create a slot machine itself.
Exactly. Yeah. That was a lot of fun.
That's amazing. Where was this when I was in university? I missed it earlier.
that was in high school.
That's great. That's amazing. So how did you build that into an actual career in technology?
Well, so what happened after that is I had a friend that was running a website called Chameleon TV. It was a website about TV series. And it was a PHP website, so it had a real backend to it. You know, there was a forum, like TV listings, everything you would find on that kind of website back then. And I was 16 at that point, and that website was doing awesome. It had a lot of visitors on it. And I even remember one day I went to the library with my friend and we saw someone on the library computer browsing that website. And yeah, I know it must not sound like much today, but I can tell you that in the early 2000s, that was a big deal.
Yeah, it's almost rock star status when you see someone using your website without you telling them about it. That's amazing.
It was the nailed rock star status.
So that's great. I love it.
So then something a little unexpected happened. When I was 17, okay, I was a customer of a startup, and it was a French startup that was offering payment solutions online. And I was pretty big into programming at that point, and I found some security vulnerabilities on their website. And so I sent them an email to report it. And then on Christmas Day, I received a response from them. It was actually the CEO directly that emailed me, and he asked if he could call me. And so he called me, told me about the company, and he explained to me that he wanted to offer me a job. And so I asked him, I thought it was a prank. Mm-hmm. And then I asked him if he knew I was 17 years old, and he said, yeah, and that's fine. And he gave me a job as an engineer, and I was 17 years old.
Wow. It's a great way to audition for something is to point out an organization's vulnerabilities. And I think that happens to quite a few hackers as well.
Yeah, I think it was more common back then than it is now, where people nowadays, they go to college, they get a CS degree, and that's like the normal path to get into engineering.
Awesome. Well, so then you started working for them, and where'd you go from there?
So from there, it gave me the idea of creating my own company. And so I created a small startup. So still back in France, right? And I was selling online ads, and I was creating small games for online players. And so I was 18 at that point. And so when I was 18 years old, at the same time, I was going to law school because my goal was not to be in computing. My goal was to become a judge. And in France, it's not like in the US where judges are elected. In France, it's a career to be a judge. So you go to law school, you more or less do the things that you would need to do to become a lawyer. And then you go to judge school and you stay there for a few years and you're a judge for the rest of your life. So
like, it's like a specialty.
Yeah.
Kind of like a surgeon would be to a doctor.
Exactly. So at the same time, at some point, I was going to law school to become a judge. I had my own one-man startup and I was employed by that payment solution company. And I realized that that's not something that's sustainable. So I resigned from the job. And so I was going to law school and I had my own company. And after a few months doing that, I realized that with my own startup, I was making more money than I was going to make as a judge.
Wow. Altogether, you'd already hit that point.
Yeah. So it's not as impressive as it sounds because judges in France don't make that much money.
Okay. Somebody who's in their teenage years, that's pretty impressive. And it shows the power of understanding technology and how it works.
Yeah, for sure. So that company that I created, it grew little by little because I started hiring people. I hired a salesperson first because that was my least favorite aspect of the business.
Yep.
Then I hired someone to do customer success to make sure we were communicating efficiently with clients and so on. Then I hired a marketing manager and more people. And it was a self-funded company and it never lost money. And so
that's amazing.
I ended up at some point with 10 or 12 employees. And at the end, I had almost $3 million in revenue.
Wow. And go ahead. Did you keep it going or did you do something with it?
So I kept it going. And at the same time, I collaborated with a large French company called HiMedia. And mm-hmm. HiMedia was facilitating credit card payments online, which was similar than the business the first company that hired me was doing. And so 10 years ago, at some point, I moved to the US. And at that point, I was still running my company and I was traveling every 4 to 6 weeks between Paris and the US. It was pretty intense to deal with the constant jet lag. And I had employees back in France. So, employees were far away. There was a time difference. It was not very convenient. So in early 2014, I decided to sell the company and I took a few months off. And then I ended up joining Confiant because a friend of mine had started Confiant in the meantime.
And was that transition from kind of really running your own business to becoming part of another team, was that a hard transition?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Yes, it was a hard transition. You're the CEO at your own company and you call the shots, you make all the decisions, right? And then you join another company and I joined it as a technical leader, also in the technical team.
Mm-hmm.
And I had people above me now. I had people that were making decisions and I had to work with them. So there was a bit of a transition for it, but there are also some positive aspects to it. It's definitely less stressful to be in engineering management than to be CEO of a company.
Well, it's pretty amazing the way you have had to transition from one form of leadership to another. Maybe you can give us some perspective on and how you got in, like how you learned leadership, how you got into it in the first place.
Yeah, what happened at some point is while I had my company, I was collaborating with another company. And it was like a large French company that was a traded company. So it had like a big structure. And what they did is they bought a website called Photolog. And Photolog is, it's kind of a website like Tumblr. And it was a big website. They bought it for $80 million. Wow. And at that point in time, in 2008, it was one of the 50th largest websites in the world.
And it was basically an image and media feed website similar to Tumblr?
Exactly. And so the CEO of that company came to me and he told me about the deal that they were buying that large website. And he asked me if I spoke English and he asked me if I wanted to go spend a few months in New York. And so let me tell you, I thought going to New York for a few months was a great idea. So I told him, of course, I speak English.
Right?
I told him, of course, I speak English. I can go because you need me to go.
I'll go right now. Let's go.
Yeah, I'll go right now. So me and one of the C-levels of the company, we went there and we stayed there for 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
And so let me tell you, my English was so bad. I could barely order food in a deli.
But your boss didn't know that at the time. You had to get by.
My boss was not aware of that. I got there and it was like Photolog was a pretty large company. It was like 40 people or something.
Uh-huh.
And our goal was to go there to help manage them and help them integrate our business and, you know, maximize our revenue together. So I got into like all these meetings with all these people and it was really difficult. It was at the same time, there was a language barrier, but there was also a culture barrier. And so I had to work with that and I really had to learn on the fly how to do that, how to make it work.
Yeah, I find that's a big part of technology and it makes it a unique kind of business where we tend to work with a lot of different regions and blend regions versus a lot of businesses that are more localized don't really kind of deal with that piece. But the culture differences can really make it hard for people, not just to come together on the business vision, but also just to come together in the way that they work, right?
Yeah, for sure. But people in the tech industry are very accepting and they are very welcoming. So it was difficult, but at the same time, I could make it work.
Were there specific things that you had to do to make that happen?
I got to know everyone and I got to understand where they were coming from, what was their story, what was the story of the company, infrastructure they had at that point, and how I could work with that to maximize our revenue because that's what our company wanted to do.
So what were some of the things you did to overcome some of those culture challenges and maybe any of the other kind of revenue-based challenges you were facing?
Yeah, so I talked a lot with the existing management of the company and I talked with everyone that had been there for a long time. And I really took the time to understand how things were working, how they were running an American company. And then I spent some time thinking about how I could work with them and how I could work with them efficiently. And so, you know, working in a company that in what was back then a foreign language to me and with people that had a very different culture than mine. It was challenging, but in a lot of positive ways, it was a real learning experience for me.
Yeah, I can imagine that would have been a very interesting challenge trying to blend culture, language, as well as like very fast moving technology. Have you had to do any of this as you moved into some of the more recent years of your career, like here at Confiant or even another thing between?
Yeah. So it's not exactly the same story, but it's a travel story as well. So a few years ago at Confiant, we were launching a new platform. And at the same time, we were trying to hire a team of engineers to work on it. And so we had very tight deadlines and we were getting severely delayed because our team was too small and because we did not have the engineering resources that we needed.
Yep.
So what happened is I asked one of my colleagues if we could meet together to work on that project. And we both flew to a city called Dayton in the state of Ohio. I don't know. Are you familiar with the city of Dayton?
No. Oh, Dayton, Ohio. Yes.
Yeah.
I am familiar with it. Yes.
So I don't know if you've been there, but it's a pretty distraction-free city. There's not a lot of things to do there.
I've been to Ohio. I have not been to Dayton itself.
Okay.
But yeah, so you can focus in that city, though.
You can certainly focus very well in that city. So unlike
New York and Paris.
Unlike New York and Paris, yes.
Right.
So my colleague and I, we worked together in an empty co-working space for an entire week to make the project happen. So at night, I would work on creating the management infrastructure I needed to manage the people we were trying to hire. So Confiant was a growing company at that point. And when I started, we were just 5 people, and now we're over 40 people. So I worked on a lot of different things at that point, like standardized process for interviews, onboarding documentation, and just like guidelines for technical procedures and things. So all this, it really helped us. And looking back, everything fell into place very well. So we ended up with a working product. And today we have the ability to maintain that product as a team because of the work we did in engineering and the work I did in management.
I want to talk about this subject for a second and ask you a couple questions. So I read a really great book called Deep Work. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that book or not. I recommend it to everyone, especially in the very busy world of technology. It basically, the author goes into the need for people to be able to create moments of deep focus throughout their, especially in certain positions, throughout their work week. And oftentimes we as a culture do not reward that. So we end up in a position where it's hard for people to get the time and the focus to do it. I think engineering, development, certainly any kind of like strategic planning for teams, they're incredibly important moments to be able to take the time and go to Dayton, Ohio, or wherever your Dayton, Ohio is, and sit down and do that deep work. How important is that to you in facilitating your teams?
So I think it's really important. It was easier back then because we were not a lot of people and I was not managing a lot of people. Nowadays, it's more difficult to not be constantly available. But in the world of Slack, where everyone can talk to you at any given time, it's just difficult to take the time that you need to focus.
Yeah, and the constant state of interruption is a challenge I think that every business has. And managing that interruption state in a way that doesn't completely eradicate or at least significantly damage employee productivity is a key thing. And even you as a leader need the time to be able to strategize and think, right?
Yeah, for sure. And it's also a problem for non-managers. Like for engineers, they say that they get in the zone where they need some time and to focus. And when they focus, they are in the zone and they can just walk and code, no problem. And when you interrupt people, it's and distracts them and it makes it very difficult for them.
I had a theory. A lot of developers I've worked with over the course of the years, and I've worked with quite a number of them, love to work at night. They work late into the night. They love it. It ends up being a career thing for them. And I really think a lot of it is because those are the time periods that become truly uninterrupted for people.
Yeah. So nowadays in 2022, when you interview people, it's harder to hire engineers so they can feel more freedom to ask more things. And a lot of people ask if they can work at night instead of during the day because they can focus better.
Yeah. It's a really common thing in this particular business.
Yeah, for sure.
So was there anything else while you've been at Confiant as a leader like that's grown out of that experience?
Yes. What happened is when we came back to the office, basically, we had a working website. So we continued hiring people. And while we were hiring people, we had clients that were beta testing this website and we were starting to get market feedback on the product. So based on the market feedback, we would put together roadmaps and I would use all the infrastructure, the management infrastructure I put together. I would use that to implement the roadmap within our team. And it's always a work in progress. It's not like I came back and I had the perfect plan. I've improved it and I improve it every day. But we ended up with something that's working and we have a very good team today of people that are happy to work together and that are happy at work.
Yeah, and I think that speaks a lot to actually pre-thinking your leadership. A lot of people get into it and do everything completely by feel, but they don't actually sit down and envision what they want to have happen and move towards that vision. And that sounds like what you took the time to do and it's been a really powerful experience. And look at the company, it's really blossomed from it as well.
Yeah, it has. And Confiant is a really good company. I'm very happy to be there. And I think everyone at Conference is really doing a great work.
Congratulations on it.
Thank you.
Gabriel's leadership journey started as many others have in the past, tinkering with and hacking solutions until he developed the foundation to run a small team. From that point on, whether he was running his own company or working as a technical leader in a fast-growing startup, he remembered that a big part of leading a team is diving in and understanding the challenges, sometimes at the code level. Listening to him share, I was reminded of the importance in pre-planning a vision and then bringing people into the approach. This playbook ultimately saves time and money, and it also helps you engineer the best team for solving the challenges ahead. All right. Well, thank you, Gabriel, for that awesome rundown. It's amazing to hear your journeys, both in France and the US, and really how you started at such a young age and got into tech leadership and figured it out and have been able to bring that work and that focus to a lot of your teams. But now we want to get into your top five tips and hear, out of all of those experiences, what is some of the sage wisdom that you have developed at this point that you'd like to share with up and coming tech leaders? What's your perspective? And let's jump in. What's tip number one?
All right. So tip number one is blameless problem solving. So it's actually one of our core values at Conference. So when you have a technical team, you always have problems and you always have bugs. And we always work to resolve issues without trying to blame whomever or what team is responsible for them. So when we have an incident, we never name which engineer is responsible for it. We try to assess what the issue is and we try to solve it. And we try to figure out what are the next steps to make sure it doesn't ever happen again.
And that's a legitimate communication challenge amongst team members, because it's a natural state for people to want to become defensive, protect themselves, or they want to deflect the responsibility of something so they don't look bad. Did you have a hard time when you initially installed that, or do you feel like it's been an easy adoption?
I think it's been an easy adoption. At some point, we did not have officially core values at the company. But when we decided to have some, it just made sense to have this one because it's something we were already living by.
That's amazing. And it's great that you had it from the very beginning.
Yeah, we did. Hopefully
you keep holding on to that.
For sure.
All right, let's jump to tip number two.
All right, tip number two is mindful hiring. So it's very hard to hire people with the exact set of skills that you need. So your priority is to hire people that have the right soft skills and values. And so if they don't know some tools or languages, you know, they can always learn them. I have heard your co-founder, Faraz, he talked about candidates having the right foundation. And that absolutely resonates with me. You need to hire people that can work with your team as a team.
Yeah, it's a big tenet we actually have as well. And especially since we're in a constant state of hiring people, that we're really thinking about, can this person fit in as a learner? Are they somebody that's going to be able to solve problems and hopefully naturally come in with your tip number one ethos? We're hiring for that instead of hiring just purely specifically for the skill, because people learn all the time and they grow. And so that kind of mindfulness in the hiring process is vital.
Yeah, for sure. And people can be different. People can have different cultures and everything. Just what
Absolutely.
Matters is that they share the same values deep down, that they can communicate as a team, they can discuss about issues in a positive manner, and they are just good people.
I love that. Awesome. That's a really good one. All right. How about tip number three?
All right. Tip number three, it's important to me. It's always learning. And so it's always learning because in my early days, when I had my own company and I was a CEO, I was 18. And when you're 18, you are not a great manager. So I can look back at it and I can see all the mistakes that I made and everything I could have and I should have done better. So I've grown a lot in the meantime, but I'm always learning from other senior people at Conference. I'm learning from the people within my team. I'm learning from the people around me and I'm learning from books. And it really helps me be a better person and it helps me be a better manager.
Well, the good news is we never really stop that process, right? Like part of why we're doing this is for the learning. I think that you have to find people that have that same ethos that we're trying to grow in a constant level, and they are flexible and they just enjoy the process.
Yeah, 100%. And so there's a book that I really like about management. It's called Managing the Unmanageable. And so it's written by a guy called Mikey Mantle. and someone called Ron Lichty. And it's a great book full of advice that can help you be a better manager. So there's one thing, I don't like the title, because managing the unmanageable, it has the connotation that engineers are unmanageable, and I don't agree with it. But everything else about the book is great, and I recommend it.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for the book tip. We've been collecting a few of those, and we're actually going to do a blog post with all of them. But this sounds like a good one. I have not heard of this one, so I look forward to going and checking it out myself.
Yeah, it's a really good book. When people become manager at my company, I go on Amazon and I buy the book for them.
Amazing. That's amazing. Okay, awesome. Let's jump to tip number four. What do you got?
All right, tip number four is help people be their best. So if you want to be an effective manager, you need to have one goal. It's help everyone in your team be their best. It all comes down to the fact that different people, they need different things. And there are some engineers, like you said, they like to work at night and they like to be by themselves and they like to focus. Some other engineers, what they do is they need to exchange a lot, they need to brainstorm, they need to talk to people to be the most productive. And so as a manager, it's also the difference between being right and being effective. You might think you know what's the right way to do something, but what really matters is what is the way to be the most effective. And you need to adapt yourself to help everyone to be the best version of themselves.
Yeah, and it sounds nuanced, but in its application, it affects the entire culture, because you're ultimately using that concept to harness the full power of the team versus just what you know individually. And I think that at a leadership level, having a keen understanding of that can make all the difference in actually leveraging the entire group versus just getting locked into the perspective that you have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, amazing. So let's get to our last tip. Tip number five, what do you got?
All right, so the last tip is to have an ongoing feedback loop. So I learned from a coach that gave us communication training that it's very important to give constant feedback to your team. So I avoid purely negative feedback. I try to give constructive feedback. So when something went wrong, I try to understand where people are coming from, because people do things with good intentions almost always. So based on that, I can discuss why it was not the best for the team, and we can discuss together on how to grow as a team. And then when there's an issue, it's very important to communicate quickly while it's still relevant.
How do you do that communication? Is it like immediately in the room, on Zoom these days, or do you wait and have a weekly structured meeting for that? What's your approach?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So most of my calls are remote, so it's on Zoom or Google Meet, but I do it as soon as there is a problem. The best time to discuss an issue is when you just had the issue.
And do you blend that in with words of encouragement as well, like when they're really doing something effectively and great?
Well, that's the thing, is constant feedback is also positive feedback.
Right.
And positive feedback and recognition for people,
yep,
it's very important. And if you want people to take your constructive feedback to heart, you need to also give them feedback when things go well. So I really try my best to credit people publicly within the company when they do good work. And I try my best to reach out to them and tell them when they do good work. Teammates should be recognized and feel appreciated for their hard work.
I love that. I 100% agree. And when you're in high pressure, fast releasing, quick moving technology environments, sometimes it's hard to take that break, give that feedback, both good and bad, and do it in a way that actually brings you tighter together as a team.
Yeah, so, for sure. And so, something we do at Conferent as well is we encourage 360 feedback, where during reviews, I ask people about their own performance and I try to get their perspective about how they are doing, but also ask them for feedback on the performance of their colleagues and feedback on the performance of their management. And it really helps me understand how we all fit together as a team and how we can all improve and work together as best as we can.
I love that. Yeah, 360 feedback is an amazing tool set. I think it's probably underutilized, but I know a number of organizations have it built in. And even just getting that on a regular kind of quick ongoing basis is really important.
So, yeah, it's really helpful.
Yeah. All right. Well, amazing. Thank you for the five tips. Thank you for the really great stories of how you came up and worked in the technology business. I learned so much from it. It was great. I think our listeners will enjoy this one. And I urge you to check out Confiant, especially if you're in the ad tech space. It's a great tool. And thank you very much for being with us today, Gabriel.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me, Ryan.
Looking back on some of Gabriel's top tips, I felt inspired by his focus on helping facilitate success for his teams. Additionally, he really hit home that the right mix of soft skills can formulate a recipe for long-term success. Having a team that is passionate about always learning is an investment in the life and evolution of the product and its company, something every great tech leader should keep in mind, especially when there's a scramble to just close out an open role on the team.